and seminar. My name is Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as the online moderator for our live broadcast. Our session today will look at the NARPM Presents session on managing institutional controls at Superfund sites. It's been sponsored by the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Before we begin the technical portion of our live broadcast, I'm going to cover some basic instructions and housekeeping items just to make sure everyone understands how the live broadcast will run. When you signed up for today's seminar, you should have received a registration email that ultimately gave you the instructions you needed to join us today. That email will point you to something known as the CLUIN Seminar homepage, where you can read more about the event, find contact information for our presenters, even download copies of the presentation materials. For now, though, you'll want to click on the button that says Go to Seminar, which will ask you to identify yourself, the people with you, and then you'll be checked and brought into our online environment. We'll be using an online tool called Adobe Connect to offer the full session interactively online, so you'll be able to sit back and watch and listen as our presenters deliver the talk. They will be controlling movement through the materials, so if you like to page back and forth through the slides or actually take your own notes, download a copy of those materials from the seminar homepage and keep them at your own location. If you have problems with the online environment in Adobe Connect, you can simply download those slides and follow along on a telephone line. By default, online audio is available for all of our participants. If you're having any problems with that online audio, first check your local speaker settings. If that doesn't solve the problem, we do have toll-free call-in information for anyone who needs it. You can use the Q&A box that appears in the lower right corner to request it at any time. But just know if you join us on the phones, we will globally mute all callers to cut down on background noises and other audio disruptions. We will take a break at the end of today's broadcast to have an interactive question and answer session with our presenters. You can submit comments and questions as well as report technical problems at any time using the Q&A box. In fact, I'd encourage you to type up your questions and comments throughout the live broadcast so that when we do get to the end, we can go through as many questions as possible in the time that's allotted. To submit your questions or comments, simply click on the empty white box at the bottom of the Q&A window, and you should be able to start typing in text. Once you've completed your question, simply hit enter or press the cartoon bubble to the right, and that will privately submit your question or comment to us. No one else will be able to read your questions, but it will be visible to our instructors. If you have technical problems, again, use the Q&A window to report those at any time. Feel free to test that functionality out as well. Again, we'll be more than happy to help troubleshoot any problems you might have. Our live broadcast is going to be recorded and will automatically be shared via email with our registered participants shortly after the live broadcast today. If you want to browse the nearly 520 previously recorded CLUIN seminars, feel free to take a look at our archives page. So roughly speaking, you guys should see a copy of the presentation slides occupying the majority of your screen on the left-hand slide. In the upper right corner of that window showing the slides, you will see a full screen button that you can click on. If you click the full screen button, that'll make the slides bigger. If you click the full screen button a second time, it'll shrink the slides back down. You can feel free to adjust the view to whatever makes sense for your location. To the right-hand side, you will see a copy of our sponsorship logo. Below that, a collection of related URLs. These are all active hyperlinks. You can click on any one of those websites and press the Browse To button to open them up locally at your location. And then below that in the lower right corner is that all-important Q&A box. To privately submit your comments or questions, simply type your text in the empty box at the very bottom, and then either hit enter or press the cartoon bubble to the right. Again, I encourage you to submit those comments and questions as we go throughout today's live broadcast. There's no need to wait for a designated break. You can type them up at any point. I've covered the basic housekeeping items, so I think I'm getting ready to turn things over to our speakers today. We're actually going to be joined by two presenters for today's live broadcast. We will be joined by Craig Bohr from EPA, as well as Steve Ridenour, again, also coming in from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. And Craig is also joining us from the EPA's Office of Site Remediation and Enforcement. We do have about 80 individuals who've checked in online. So with that, gentlemen, I'll go ahead and turn things over to you to kick off today's live broadcast.
Well, thanks very much, Jean. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to our NARPM Presents webinar on managing institutional controls at Superfund sites. As Jean mentioned, my name is Steve Ridenour. I work in the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and I'm joined by Craig Bohr, who works in the Office of Site Remediation Enforcement. We'll both be presenting the material here today, and you'll notice we'll be switching back and forth between that material. Today's presentation will provide a high-level overview of ICs, including some general background information, highlights of EPA's most recent IC guidance documents for the various stages of the IC lifecycle, and a discussion of some recent limited case law on the 2002 Brownfields Amendments. After we cover this material, we'd like to use the balance of our time to answer any questions that you may have submitted throughout the presentation. So first, let's start with some basics. EPA defines ICs as non-engineered instruments, such as administrative and legal controls, that help to minimize the potential for exposure to contamination and protect the integrity of a response action. To achieve this, ICs limit land or resource use by providing information that helps modify or guide human behavior at a site. They can be used on a more temporary basis, for instance, to prevent consumption of groundwater until federal MCLs are reached, or on a more permanent basis, such as a capped landfill that will have waste left in place in perpetuity. For purposes of this presentation and our guidance, we divide ICs into four distinct categories or types. The first is proprietary controls. Proprietary controls refer to controls on land or resource use that are established between a property owner and a second party who can enforce these controls. Common examples include easements that restrict use and restrictive covenants. State and tribal law typically authorize proprietary controls. Some states have enacted statutes that directly authorize these types of controls for the purpose of preventing use in conflict with environmental contamination or remedies. These statutes tend to divide into ones modeled after the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act, or as you'll see throughout the presentation, UECA, or other non-UECA statutes. These UECA and non-UECA state statutes can provide advantages over traditional common law proprietary controls. And later in this presentation, Craig will go into some detail about the potential benefits of these UECA laws. The second IC category is governmental controls. These types of controls impose restrictions on land or resource use using the authority of a government entity. Typical examples of governmental controls include zoning, building codes, groundwater use regulations, commercial fishing bans, and sports or recreational fishing limits. For federal facility sites, in many cases, federal landholding agencies such as the Department of Defense possess the authority to enforce ICs on their property. At active federal facilities, land or resource use restrictions may be addressed in base master plans, facility construction review processes, or facility digging permit systems. Third type of IC category is enforcement and permit tools with IC components. These are legal tools such as administrative orders, permits, federal facility agreements, and consent decrees that limit certain site activities or require the performance of specific activities, and in this case, maybe monitoring and reporting on IC effectiveness at a site. These legal tools may be issued unilaterally, for instance, in the case of a unilateral administrative order, or negotiated in the case of a consent decree. And the fourth IC category is informational devices. Informational devices provide information or notification often as recorded notice in property records or as advisories to local communities, tourists, recreational users, or other interested persons that residual contamination remains on a site. Informational devices generally do not provide enforceable restrictions. Typical informational devices include state registries of contaminated sites, notices and deeds, tracking systems, and shellfish consumption advisories. And just to note, depending on the cleanup authority of the site, you may hear a few different terms which can include ICs as we define them here in this presentation, but also engineered controls like fencing and security guards. In the federal facilities program, you may hear the term land use controls or LUCs. In the removal program, you may hear the term post-removal site controls, or PRSCs. And so we just wanted to kind of call that out, that you may see this different nomenclature across programs, and it may include ICs or not.
So hi, everyone. This is Craig Bohr. Now that we've talked about some IC basics, I briefly want to give you an idea of our Superfund program IC workload that we deal with here at EPA. In a broad sense, we care about ICs and issuing guidance documents related to IC implementation because there are a significant number of sites where ICs are not implemented or where some sort of IC issue exists. From a regulatory perspective, our Superfund program IC implementation area amounts to quite a significant workload for our program and council. And of course, this is just one of the cleanup programs that rely on ICs. Our regional offices currently track IC information in an EPA Superfund IC registry called the IC Tracking System, or ICTS. This interface mostly tracks Superfund construction complete sites, of which there are about 1,150 or so the last I checked. Now, construction complete means that these are sites where the physical construction of all cleanup actions is complete, all intermediate threats have been addressed, and all long-term threats are under control. The ICTS tracking system gives sites a specific IC designation. Either there are no ICs required at the site, IC implementation remains needed, ICs are required and implemented, or we just don't have publicly available information on the IC status at the site. Now, these construction complete sites that may involve some amount of future IC work come to just over 50% of sites in the ICTS database, so this obviously represents a significant amount of work in terms of getting ICs implemented at sites. I should note that we're continuing to improve our IC tracking here at EPA so that it becomes a part of what we do daily. We do want to allow for a more thorough documentation of ICs moving forward. Next, I want to talk very briefly about five-year reviews and what the information in those five-year reviews is showing when it comes to identifying sites with IC issues. Steve will talk a little more later about five-year reviews when it comes to maintaining ICs at sites, but I'll just say that in general, the purpose of five-year reviews is to evaluate the implementation and performance of the remedy in order to determine if the remedy is or will be protective going forward of human health and the environment. So our RPMs make an IC protectiveness determination at a site or at the operable unit level, and IC issues may be identified, and the document may recommend the need for additional evaluation or follow-up actions included as highlighted issues and recommendations. Recommendations that may be given to address barriers to implementation may include creating an IC plan, which Steve will talk a little more about later, evaluating IC effectiveness, implementing ICs, and also working with other parties to enforce ICs. I should note that the IC component of a five-year review is just one component of the review, and so the IC recommendation could be one out of a number of other recommendations. There are an average of about 230 to 260 five-year reviews that have been conducted per year recently, and when we look at those five-year reviews, a significant percentage of them have identified IC-related issues, showing that there continue to be barriers to implementation. And this backs up what I was just talking about and what we're seeing in our own IC tracking. So how have we, in the last few years here at EPA headquarters, worked to assist our regional personnel and other interested stakeholders to help address some of these barriers associated with IC planning, implementation, maintenance, and enforcement that we've seen in tracking ICs at sites? Well, as you can see on this slide, we've continued to develop tools to address various IC issues, and these tools include important IC guidance documents that provide roles and responsibilities for the IC lifecycle and assist our regional staff with particular IC implementation issues. We'll be discussing concepts found in these guidance documents throughout this webinar, and I'll talk a bit more about our newest handbook on implementing ICs in Indian Country, but I want to briefly introduce these documents here for you all before we continue further. First is the Guide to Planning, Implementing, Maintaining, and Enforcing ICs at Contaminated Sites, what we call the PIME guidance. It was released late last year. While it's fairly Superfund heavy, it does identify and address common issues that may be encountered when using ICs pursuant to several of our cleanup programs. The guidance also integrates concepts from other disciplines such as property law, real estate, land use planning, and community engagement, and it describes the roles of states, tribes, local governments, and communities in IC selection and maintenance. The PIM does recommend early coordination with stakeholders. That's something that I'll be going back to throughout the webinar, and also supports our enforcement first policy for ICs, that is, getting the responsible party to pay for appropriate cleanup costs. The guidance also focuses more heavily on the first two categories of ICs that Steve mentioned, proprietary and governmental controls. Next is the ICAP guidance, which is a guide to preparing IC implementation and assurance plans at contaminated sites, and this was released in conjunction with the PIM guidance. The ICAP guidance provides our regions with a template for developing IC plans at sites where the response action includes ICs. Steve will discuss ICAPs a little more in detail later on. Next, the IC supplement to our Superfund program office's five-year review guidance was released in 2011. The supplement provides recommendations for conducting five-year reviews for the IC component of remedies in a manner similar to the review of other remedy components. Steve will also expand on five-year reviews, as I said, later in the webinar. And finally, I want to mention our latest cross-program handbook. It was just released last month, called Implementing ICs in Indian Country. This handbook notes the unique circumstances associated with implementing ICs in Indian Country and reinforces our policy to engage tribes early in the cleanup process. And I'll talk about this new handbook more in depth later on. So you can find all these documents that I just mentioned on our IC policy page, which is linked to on this slide. I should note that these guidance documents don't represent regulations and don't create new liabilities or limit or expand obligations under any federal law. So now that I've talked about these recent guidance documents, I'll hand it over to Steve to kick off a more in-depth discussion on the first part of the ICC life cycle. And he'll talk about the general considerations for planning ICs. He'll also talk about developing IC plans, which the ICAP guidance directly addresses.
Thanks, Craig. Recommend that a preliminary IC evaluation be included as part of site investigation efforts. So this is for Superfund generally, the RIFS process, the remedial investigation feasibility study process under Superfund. Particularly early on, but throughout the whole pipeline, we encourage our regions to seek input from stakeholders. In this example, state, tribal, local governments, responsible parties, affected communities, and maybe even natural resource trustees, to ensure that the most appropriate ICs are ultimately selected and implemented. Through the RFS process, it will be important to identify the cleanup objectives with respect to the ICs, so that it's clear what the intended purpose of the ICs are to begin with. The consequence of IC objectives not being clear can manifest itself in decision documents, records of decision under Superfund, that provide very vague information on ICs. And in that case, the details regarding what the objectives of those ICs, what will be restricting, how long they'll be in place, are not there. And it's extremely critical that that information is. The most appropriate IC instrument or combination of IC instruments to implement depend on a number of factors, including the intended duration of an IC. For example, for an IC that will be in place on a more short-term basis until restoration at a site is achieved, you may not need to primarily focus on finding an IC that runs with the land. As another example for a situation where you're dealing with a large number of parcels requiring a restriction, such as lead contaminated soils cleanup in a neighborhood, proprietary controls may become difficult to negotiate and execute because they're property specific, potentially leading to disparate implementation and compliance among the neighborhood's properties. As an alternative, you may want to consider a governmental control, such as an ordinance, to cover a large area within a single legal and regulatory requirement. However, ordinances are only possible when you have cooperation and continued communication with state and local governments. As a means to comprehensively plan for ICs, we recommend the development of an IC plan, or what we call an IC implementation and assurance plan. This is what we call an ICAP for short. An ICAP is a document designed to systematically establish and document the activities necessary to implement and ensure the long-term stewardship of ICs and specify the persons or organizations that will be responsible for conducting these activities. For example, an ICAP can document the frequency with which a local government will monitor ICs at a site. Because ICAPs can serve as a single source of concise, site-specific IC information, ICAPs can be useful tools for not only planning, but also for assuring effective implementation, maintenance, and enforcement of ICs. In this way, they are very similar to the purpose of an O&M plan, which provides that sort of technical level of detail for the engineering components of a response. By attempting to specify the roles of stakeholders, the ICAP can often help facilitate a common understanding among all the relevant parties as to their roles and obligations on the ICs. For example, in a situation involving a zoning ordinance that has been selected as an IC at a site, an ICAP could help explain how EPA, the state, responsible parties are supposed to be notified before proposed zoning amendment, variance, or similar action is considered. We recommend that an ICAP be initiated prior to or at the same time as a remedial design of the engineered response action and finalized with the completion of that same engineered remedial action. This approach should allow time for site managers, site attorneys, and other interested parties to complete detailed discussions with potential IC implementers, inspectors, and other stakeholders. And as Craig mentioned before, we have an ICAP, we have a guidance on ICAPs, and a sample ICAP plan template is included in that guidance, so we really do encourage you to check that out.
So now that we move on to the next slide, before I get into a more detailed discussion on implementing ICs, particularly implementing proprietary controls, I briefly just want to mention the fact that some states have developed statutory authorities to implement and maintain ICs. Many of these statutory authorities are based around the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act, or UECA. UECA is a state model law that provides for a statutorily defined voluntary agreement, which is known as an environmental covenant, and this restricts activities on sites where some contamination remains in place. Now, UECA was drafted and approved by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws 10 years ago, back in 2003, and at this point, a little over half of the U.S. states and territories have passed UECA at this point. I think it's somewhere in the upper 20s, but it's a little difficult to nail down the exact number. Other states have also developed their own statutory authority to implement and maintain proprietary controls. Some of these are based off of UECA. Some of them are similar, but other states do have their own statutory authority. So what does an environmental covenant do, and what are some of its advantages? Well, first and foremost, it imposes activity and use limitations, which are restrictions or obligations with respect to the real property concerned. These are really the heart of the environmental covenant, and their purpose is to eliminate or reduce exposure pathways to chemicals of concern, also provide notice to parties of the presence of hazardous substances, and also identify site uses which should or should not occur in the future. I'll note that some states have actually model activity and use limitations, which make it easier on the drafter to put together the environmental covenant. So, you know, if your state has these model use limitations, it's much easier to kind of take from these models and throw those into the environmental covenant. An environmental covenant also is a legal instrument where the activity and use limitations are recorded, and the covenant runs with the land and is perpetual in duration, meaning it remains in effect until actively removed, and it's binding on subsequent purchasers or tenants. A UECA environmental covenant also eliminates common law defenses, and it addresses related legal issues like privity, marketable title statutes, eminent domain, tax liens, adverse possession, those kinds of things. And valid covenants are protected from being inadvertently extinguished. further an environmental covenant identifies a what's known as a holder, which is a term, if this wasn't in a Uinta-based covenant, it would be the grantee of a limited property interest. And it also broadens the universe of those who have a right to enforce the covenant. And this enforcement ability, it gives a broad array of interested parties the ability to enforce the use limitations contained in the covenant, and this helps ensure that these controls remain in place. Obviously, at EPA, we have an interest in having, you know, more parties involved in the covenant with enforcing these activity and use restrictions. UECA also requires that the agency overseeing the cleanup be a signatory to the covenant, and notice is also required to any signatories or possessors or affected third parties. I should note that with most sites where EPA, where we're involved and where we're interested in implementing an environmental covenant, we will have a joint or lead role, and we'd be signing as it's called the agency. We'd have a right to enforce the covenant by being an agency. We also could be named as a party with enforcement rights in the environmental covenant. We can be an agency with this enforcement status without obtaining a property interest, and we typically would want to avoid being a UECA holder in this regard, as we do have limited property acquisition authority. Now, I should note some things that UECA doesn't do. It doesn't impose specific substantive cleanup standards or address liability issues. It doesn't force the existing property owner to agree to long-term controls. It is a voluntary agreement, but I should note that even though it is a voluntary agreement, typically ICs are selected as part of the remedy decision process, and if parties don't want to enter into this proprietary control, it may call into question the remedy that's been selected. So it's voluntary, but, you know, there are caveats to that. It also doesn't bind prior property interests unless these are subordinated. But as I mentioned, the covenant does run with the land going forward, so in that way it affects future property interests. And finally, it also doesn't provide independent condemnation or citizen suit authority. So just to wrap that all up, UECA does provide a clear mechanism for the creation, enforcement, modification, and termination of environmental covenants to control the use of property and permit safe reuse. And owners can transfer property knowing that restrictions will be respected in the future. Generally, owners of contaminated property are responsible for addressing any contamination on their property. And this also includes implementing and maintaining ICs. Under CERCLA, non-source landowners, meaning those that didn't directly cause any contamination on site, or landowners who purchased property after it became contaminated, may be liable for cleanup costs, and implementation and management of ICs in these situations may be complex and problematic under certain circumstances. There are certain scenarios where the response action can call for an IC to be placed on the property of a landowner who did not cause or contribute to the contamination. Some of these scenarios might be that contamination may migrate from the source property to the neighboring property. Obviously, the owner of the neighboring property didn't cause that contamination. An IC may be needed on a property as part of monitoring for the threat of an upgrading release, or as I mentioned, a new purchaser may acquire property that has existing contamination on site that was caused by other parties. In general, PRPs at enforcement lead sites are typically responsible, as I said, for implementing controls on their own land and obtaining and recording proprietary controls from any other landowners whose land must be restricted. And I'll talk about this a little more about the requirement that a PRP use what are known as best efforts on the next slide. After investigation and determination that ICs may be necessary, notification of all affected landowners of ICs being considered, why they're needed, and implementation proposals are encouraged. One important thing is proper communication here. It may help ensure that the landowner has the opportunity to comment on and participate in the remedial process. Good communication also helps ensure the landowner understands the cleanup goals and the need for ICs, understands our legal authority, for example, in terms of property access, site cleanup orders, property acquisition. Good communication also helps ensure that the landowner understands potential liabilities and available liability protections and relevant enforcement discretion policies. So I can't stress that enough. Proper communication. Speaking of enforcement tools and enforcement discretion policies, we do have tools that may help alleviate some concerns that non-source landowners or new purchasers may have in terms of liability exposure as owners of contaminated property. For instance, for quite a while we've had a residential property owner policy which addresses the concerns of residential owners that they may be subject to an enforcement action even though they had not caused contamination directly. We also have a contiguous property owner policy which discusses our enforcement position with respect to contiguous property owners. I'll briefly mention CPOs a little bit later. Also, our contaminated aquifer policy, which discusses our enforcement position with respect to owners that contain an aquifer that's become contaminated as a result of migration that's subsurface migration, basically. So, in general, we state that in these specified circumstances, we will use our enforcement discretion to not take enforcement actions against these types of property owners. Of course, these are subject to certain circumstances, and if you're interested more in learning about these policies, we do have a Brownfields policy and guidance page on our enforcement website. There are also the self-implementing CERCLA landowner liability protections. For instance, the bona fide prospective purchaser, or BFPP protection, which I'll talk a bit more about later when it comes to IC continuing obligation requirements. We do encourage, again, maintaining communication by reminding citizens and affected landowners of the general cleanup process, how a landowner might be able to participate, and the importance of ICs to ensure long-term protectiveness of remedial actions, human health, and the environment. Finally, in terms of landowner issues specifically, states and or local governments may be helpful in reaching out and engaging with affected landowners. When it comes to a discussion about implementing proprietary controls, I should note that first and foremost, they typically rely heavily on state law and practice, and practitioners should really be aware of all relevant state legislation and regulations that may affect the effectiveness of ICs when they are used as part of a cleanup. For instance, determining if you're in a UECA or non-UECA based jurisdiction and have to deal with that particular statute. There are some varying considerations in implementing proprietary controls based on whether a viable PRP is involved in the cleanup. So at enforcement lead sites, or what are also known as PRP lead sites, where ICs have been selected as part of the cleanup, the responsibility to implement the proprietary control rests with the PRP because they're generally obligated to implement the controls as part of the remedial action. Our model RDRA, which means Remedial Design, Remedial Action, Consent Decree, addresses the need for PRPs to implement proprietary control. Just quickly, a consent decree is a legal document approved and issued by a judge that formalizes an agreement that's reached between us and the PRP, where that PRP will perform all or part of the cleanup. So some of the requirements in that model CD are that the PRP is required to execute and record proprietary controls in the appropriate land records office that grant a right of access to conduct any activity regarding the consent decree. Further, parties that settle have responsibilities to implement proprietary controls on property that they don't own. I mentioned that in the last slide. This can be a timely process, and it involves working with the affected landowner. Our model consent decree also has a provision that states that PRPs must use best efforts, as I mentioned before, to implement and maintain the proprietary control, and they must negotiate with the affected landowner. So what does best efforts mean exactly? Well, best efforts includes the payment of reasonable sums of money to obtain access, an agreement to restrict land or water use, proprietary controls, and or an agreement to release or subordinate a prior lien or encumbrance. So the PRP can do all these things to negotiate with the affected landowner, and this is mapped out, as I said, in our model consent decree provisions. Now, the non-source landowner may be unwilling in certain circumstances to implement a proprietary control despite the PRP's best efforts. For instance, the landowner may disagree with the cleanup approach. There may be liability concerns or concerns over the cost of cleanup. And in these cases, EPA can seek to enforce the relevant provisions of the consent decree or order depending on site-specific circumstances. Our model orders do contain IC provisions, so we may be able to get the PRP to implement a proprietary control as part of the cleanup, but as I said, this depends on certain circumstances of the case, and I'll talk more about some enforcement tools a little later on. We do have a limited property acquisition authority, and we could condemn a property interest for purposes of conducting a remedial action, but we really don't prefer to do that. Or depending on the circumstances, it may be prudent to select and implement another type of IC. For instance, the site team may possibly feel that a good solution is to have a recorded notice that would be useful as an interim IC. Also, I should note that the PRP is required to abide by specified land and resource use restrictions and commit to carrying out long-term oversight, monitoring, and enforcement. So that was at sites where the PRP is conducting cleanup. At CERCLA fund lead sites, the responsibility to secure implementation of the proprietary control lies with us or the state, depending on the lead agency. EPA has a duty to ensure that selected ICs are implemented, and again, the level of our involvement depends on the type of IC being implemented and the authority being used. It's recommended that site managers provide attorneys with a clear scope of the land or resource area to be restricted. I do want to note that at both enforcement lead and fund lead sites, it's important for the party doing the work, whether that be us or the PRP, to review title. And this is really essential in getting the proprietary control implemented. A proper title review makes sure that the property is owned by who we think owns it, and we can identify encumbrances like mortgages or liens that could impact the validity of the proprietary control. At enforcement lead sites, we do have model documents that lay out title requirements, and we can require parties to perform title searches. A critical issue in the effective implementation of proprietary controls can be the selection of the grantee, or as I said, holder, as it's known in the Uyghur-based jurisdictions. The grantee holds the covenant or title to the real property interest and has the primary responsibility for maintaining and enforcing the specific proprietary control. The grantee can be states, PRPs, local governments, civic organizations, or EPA, but as I mentioned before, we have a limited property acquisition authority, so typically we wouldn't want to be the grantee. The viability of potential grantees should be performed prior to or during the response selection process, and important considerations are whether the potential grantee is likely to exist for the duration of the control, whether the person or entity is willing and able to maintain the IC and also take legal action against violators. Also, it's important to ask whether it would be appropriate to assign the grantee role to an entity not accountable through an enforcement instrument like a consent decree. If no suitable grantee exists, then alternative ICs or even a change in the cleanup level may be necessary. I want to say a few words about drafting the proprietary control instrument and how subordination may be a necessary step to deal with encumbrances that may impact the validity, viability of the proprietary control. So depending on whether it's an enforcement or fund lead site, the PRP, EPA, or the state would typically draft the proprietary control document. The EPA site attorney and manager will typically review and approve the instrument. I do want to say that when we're talking about legally effective proprietary controls, we really put an emphasis on that, and ones that are clearly drafted are obviously preferred and important in this area. We as a regulator definitely want parties to understand what the document is and what's required in the document. So being able to properly implement a proprietary controls in the eyes of the law leads to proper enforcement down the road and obviously long-term durability of the IC. It may be useful for the PRP to seek the services of an experienced real estate attorney in the design and implementation of the proprietary controls. This is because the exact requirements often vary by jurisdiction. Additional documentation that may prove helpful along with the actual proprietary control instrument can be title search documents, site surveys, and maps. These can more clearly define the property and IC boundaries and may prevent unnecessary confusion and also may facilitate beneficial reuse going forward. Now on subordination, it's important to attempt to resolve these types of subordination issues early in the IC evaluation and selection process, as there are cases where the proprietary control may be subordinate to a prior or what's known as a senior interest in property. To resolve these issues, a subordination agreement may be used as a necessary step, which is a legal instrument used to make the claim of one party, or the senior party, now junior to the claim of the most recent party. So as I mentioned before, the importance of reviewing title is critical in this regard, and a thorough title search could be conducted to see if a subordination agreement is necessary. I should also note that there may be unrecorded interests like leases that may also need to be subordinated to ensure compliance. Before I talk about some types of governmental controls, moving on to that type of IC, I do want to talk about one additional factor that may be at play in implementing ICs. This is if the property is located in Indian country. There may be unique circumstances and considerations at play when it comes to implementing ICs in Indian country. And as I mentioned before, our newest handbook addresses some of these considerations. First, I should note that we here at EPA have a tribal consultation policy, and this is integrated into the PIME guidance, noting that consultation is encouraged where ICs are considered as a component of the site response action on tribal lands. Consultation is generally initiated soon after a cleanup site is identified as being in Indian country. Now, our new November 2013 handbook is entitled Implementing Institutional Controls in Indian Country, and this provides answers to some fundamental questions that EPA regional staff may have on the impact of Indian law on the process of implementing ICs in Indian Country. It also does promote a consistent national policy on ICs in Indian Country at properties addressed by EPA cleanup programs and authorities. Tribal sovereignty and different land ownership types may lead to complex jurisdiction and implementation issues in Indian Country, and information gaps concerning ICs may have a chilling effect in that regions may be wary to implement ICs, leading to a lesser degree of environmental protection overall. Property ownership and the Department of the Interior may play a role in IC implementation. For instance, this section touches on the different types of property ownership in Indian Country, whether a property is held as trust land, whether it's subject to some sort of restriction, or it's held without restriction in fee simple, and how land management may be complicated depending on that type of ownership. The section also discusses challenges in identifying which government entity holds zoning authority on tribal lands and how we here at EPA may assist with governmental control implementation. The second section is about land records and title concerns by explaining how the Department of the Interior, through its Bureau of Indian Affairs, maintains property title, how some ICs may require tribal approval, and possible disadvantages of recording on title. The section discusses how documents affecting title to trust and restricted lands are managed by offices called Land Transfer and Records Offices, which are the offices within the DOI's Bureau of Indian Affairs. And these offices' roles are explained in conducting title examinations. The section also notes that EPA needs the landowner's agreement to implement proprietary control on either trust or restricted land, and they also need tribal government approval. The steps to obtain approval from the Bureau of Indian Affairs are also mentioned. Finally, the last section is about working with tribes by addressing cultural traditions and EPA resources to work with tribes. The section notes that principles of sovereignty may prevent mandating the tribe to implement an IC. EPA may need to work with the liable party and the tribe by entering into agreements to implement the IC. The Working with Tribes section also discusses the benefits of integrating land management into long-term stewardship by using cultural informational devices. These can be oral traditions or bilingual materials, for instance. And finally, the section also notes that other available resources to effectively work with tribes are available. So we are glad here that this new handbook has been released. It supports our priorities to reach out to tribes, capacity building, transparency, environmental justice issues. So if you're interested in this, please take a look at it via the earlier IC policy documents link that was on an earlier slide. Now moving on to governmental controls. Generally, conventional government regulations and activities like zoning or land use controls, groundwater restrictions, building codes, for instance, often can be relied on and leveraged to serve as highly effective ICs if they're appropriately implemented, maintained, and enforced. An important note to start out about governmental controls is our role in their implementation. Really, state and local governments have discretion to impose these controls, and we have no authority to compel governments to amend or adopt new regulations to impose an IC or keep regulations that currently impose an IC. As Steve previously mentioned, we do encourage site managers and attorneys to help document and clarify roles and responsibilities and document the legal authorities of the parties in terms of governmental controls. So we do encourage the development of IC plans, ICAPs, or equivalent documents. I'll touch on a few specific types of governmental controls, as you can see on the slide. First, groundwater use restrictions. These are state laws that commonly involve water use restrictions and well construction and abandonment requirements. These restrictions can take the form of groundwater management zones, protection areas, prohibitions or limitations on certain uses of groundwater, capping or closing of groundwater wells, and limitations on new drilling. Implementation of these restrictions can take time, and their potential usefulness as an IC and the jurisdiction's willingness to monitor and enforce them really does vary based on the jurisdiction and site specifics. Again, early coordination in this area is encouraged to increase the likelihood of implementing the IC. Moving on to zoning ordinances, these are generally an exercise of state, local, or tribal government, and they can designate their regulatory authority in this area, in turn, to municipal or county governments. Zoning ordinances can serve as effective instruments if the zoning designation matches the goals of the IC, for instance, if the goal is to limit residential exposure. Some limitations on zoning ordinances are that the designation could be of a limited duration, there could be rezoning involved, variances, or cumulative zoning, meaning less intensive uses may be permitted in zones designated for intensive uses. It is important to note that zoning ordinances should be fully maintained and enforced over the long term, and again, local government coordination is important in this regard. Here quickly are some other examples of governmental controls that may be effective in certain circumstances. First, fish consumption bans are usually administered by state health agencies or resource management agencies. waterway use restrictions are generally put in place to prevent uses that could damage sediment caps and are usually administered by state or local agencies or by the U.S. Coast Guard, even in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, if we're talking about a navigational area. And then permits and ordinances, these regulate certain activities, for instance, a ban on swimming in specified areas, or a one-call services alert, which Steve will be touching on in a bit. And speaking of Steve, I'll throw it back to him now so he can talk a little bit about the third category of ICs, which are informational devices, and he'll also talk about maintaining ICs.
Thanks, Greg. As I mentioned earlier, informational devices are designed to provide information or notification that residual contamination remains on site. I'm going to briefly touch on some of the most common types of informational devices, as you can see some examples in the slide there. Recorded notices are contained in deeds or other instruments, and unlike proprietary controls, are generally not enforceable restrictions on the use of the property. They're intended to provide notice to those who review the chain of title that contamination exists and can help identify potential land or resource uses that could result in unacceptable exposures. Some benefits of recorded notices are that they may effectively discourage developers from purchasing property for inappropriate land uses and lenders from funding development for such uses. They may also notify property purchasers of hazardous substance releases, and this may prove relevant for the purposes of CERCLA's landowner liability protections. For instance, you can't be a contiguous property owner or an innocent landowner if you have knowledge of contamination on the site. In some jurisdictions, notices can be removed by the owner or expire, so they should remain in land records and should have a refiling requirement. Some states maintain registries of ICs or contaminated sites that may serve as a useful informational device. Examples include database listings, web-based maps, and inventories of contaminated sites or ICs. A word of caution that the procedures for listing and delisting sites from these types of registries can vary from state to state. Listing is, in some cases, discretionary, and sites can be potentially out of date when they are on the registry. But when used with other cleanup measures, registry listings can be a useful component of an overall site response. And finally, advisories are publicly issued warnings that provide notice to potential resource users of existing or potential risks associated with that use. For example, advisories may be issued to private well users or fish consumers. These are generally issued by public health agencies, either at the federal, state, or local level. And one example that we've highlighted in the past in guidance and I wanted to, and perhaps in trainings over the years, is the Fish Contamination and Education Collaborative, which operates at the Palos Verdes Shelf portion of the Montrose Chemical Superfund site. The FCCEC works to disseminate information and warn communities, anglers, and businesses about the risks of consuming PCB and DDT contaminated fish at the site, and operates in conjunction with the monitoring program and enforcement efforts. This example is a great success story because the level of cooperation among various levels of government and community-based organizations that ensure that the IC program at the site continues to protect human health and from contaminated fish at the site. So on to maintaining ICs. Generally speaking, the first and foremost approach to maintaining ICs is rigorous periodic monitoring and reporting. This provides the site manager the ability to proactively address any potential weaknesses in ICs revealed by changes in land or resource use. Fundamentally, monitoring should evaluate whether ICs remain in place and whether they're still effective in meeting the intended objectives of the remedy. In most situations, it is recommended that monitoring and reporting requirements be layered to increase the likelihood that any breaches will be detected early. This can be achieved by assigning the monitoring responsibility for an IC to more than just one party. On the other hand, it is important to ensure that each party with monitoring and reporting responsibility is held accountable and does not make shared responsibility a reason for less vigilant monitoring individually. In addition, the site manager may want to include frequent reminders of the restrictions via such means as correspondence, notification and access letters for routine monitoring, and even affixing warning labels to well cases, casings that reiterate applicable restrictions at the site. In the absence of information to support a different review period, we generally recommend annual reviews of the ICs. And as Craig noted, state one-call systems may be an effective way to help ensure that activities, particularly site excavations, do not conflict with land or resource use restrictions during the life cycle that the IC is in place of the site. States typically establish one-call systems to help excavators identify underground utility lines and other infrastructure before they start digging into the ground. But depending on how such systems are designed and operated, they may also be useful for identifying ICs. A shorter review period or more frequent monitoring that supplements an annual review may be appropriate when more frequent land activities or potential changes in land or resource use are anticipated at the site. This could be the case, for example, in urban settings. Long-term stewardship procedures should be in place to ensure proper maintenance and monitoring of effective ICs. The procedures can be included in ICAP or similarly detailed plan on ICs. The plan should address procedures to ensure regular inspection of ICs at the site, and in appropriate circumstances, an annual certification to EPA that the required ICs are in place and effective would be useful. The site attorney may want to review updated title work to the property to determine whether proprietary controls have been modified or terminated, and could review the local government's zoning regulations for the site to determine if there have been any changes. The five-year review process provides a great built-in opportunity to review the status of ICs at a site. Sites that rely on ICs as part of the remedy will most likely be subject to the five-year review requirement under CERCLA, because waste will be left in place above levels that allow for what we call unlimited use and unrestricted exposure. Generally, that's the level of cleanup where no restrictions on land or resource use are anticipated. In addition to a protectiveness determination, five-year reviews may identify issues and recommend the need for additional evaluation or follow-up actions, and these are included in the report itself. The biggest issue in five-year reviews still with respect to ICs is getting them implemented. Other common issues include the need to develop an IC plan or the need to enforce ICs due to an observed breach at the site. EPA has released guidance on evaluating ICs during the five-year review process in September 2011, and we encourage you also to take a look at this guidance. As an additional step for long-term stewardship, the site manager and site attorney should actively encourage relevant stakeholders, such as states, tribes, local governments, to help ensure proper monitoring of ICs. These monitoring activities include inspecting and reporting on sites, following the issuance of building and excavation permits to ensure compliance with their terms, inspecting and reporting on sites for compliance with proprietary controls when the state, local government, or tribe is the grantee or holder in a UECA-based jurisdiction, and inspecting and reporting on the compliance of zoning restrictions, and finally, reporting proposed zoning amendments that may significantly alter land use at the site or in the vicinity of the site.
So, when we're talking about enforcement, there are certain negotiation and enforcement tools available for dealing with potential problems involving improper or incomplete implementation, maintenance, or breaches of ICs. Depending on the type of IC, enforcement procedures will vary. When it comes to enforcing ICs, an effective first step is to seek voluntary compliance first through early problem identification and informal communication, such as site visits, sending letters, or creating a record. Our broad, what's known as the enforcement first policy, applies to any actions needed to ensure the implementation and effectiveness of ICs. It's our expectation that PRPs do the work to clean up sites, including enforcement of the IC if they have authority to do so, or working with those who have the authority. I should note that for proprietary controls in particular, legal and procedural requirements may vary considerably among states. As I mentioned before, whether you're in a common law or UECA-based statute, so we do recommend that attorneys become familiar with the particular state requirements. However, there will likely be clear enforcement procedures outlined in the state statute, if applicable, so it should be fairly straightforward to keep on top of the requirements. Typically, parties to a covenant may enforce that covenant, but in UECA-based jurisdictions, many parties typically have enforcement authority, as I mentioned before, including parties to the covenant, parties with a right to enforce the covenant, federal or state environmental agencies, a person whose interest is affected by a violation of the covenant, or local governments. I will note that the relief that we seek from a party under proprietary control would generally include injunctive relief. It would generally be injunctive relief. We want some sort of activity to stop as opposed to seeking monetary penalties. For governmental controls, enforcement would be by the relevant local entity with authority to do so, and this may involve some amount of outreach with the local government. For example, even though we may oversee and approve a response action, local governmental agencies typically control things like zoning and land use designations, as I mentioned previously. Our guidance recommends using the administrative process to communicate among levels of government to enforce the governmental control. We also recommend the use of IC plans or other agreements to set up enforcement procedures in advance, as we've talked about at different points in this webinar. And these documents may contain provisions that describe appropriate steps to take if local or state agencies are not maintaining or enforcing governmental controls. We would expect at sites where an IC plan is being used that it would document the enforcement procedure for the ICs being relied upon, including the roles and responsibilities of parties. Enforcement and permit tools that may be used to require implementation and maintenance of an IC or seek a remedy for an IC breach include consent decrees, federal facility agreements, unilateral administrative orders, and permits. These tools may have underlying substantive restrictions in them, for instance, that the settling party should not use property for residential use. These tools are only enforceable against parties to the agreement. They don't run with the land, for instance, and enforcement can vary based on the type of tool and relief sought. For instance, consent decrees are enforced judicially. Obviously, administrative orders on consent can be enforced administratively. The remedies available under these tools may include requiring the PRP to implement the IC or pay penalties in some circumstances. Payments may be required to reimburse an agency that's incurred any cost of implementing or maintaining the control. It may include the notion to cover the costs incurred when addressing IC breaches, or may include the PRP may have to pay certain penalties, for instance. Now, moving on from that, I'd like to move on to an area of CERCLA that's becoming more active and where we're starting to see a bit of case law recently, and this relates to CERCLA's landowner liability protections. The 2002 Brownfields Amendments provided new protections to CERCLA liability applicable to certain categories of landowners. Most notably, the bona fide prospective purchaser provision, or BFPP. BFPPs are persons who meet the criteria of CERCLA sections 10140 and 107R, who buy property after January 11, 2002. They must perform all appropriate inquiry prior to purchase and may buy knowing or having reason to know of contamination on the property. This last requirement sets BFPPs apart from the other two protected classes of parties who cannot know or have reason to know of contamination found on their property. The first group of these are contiguous property owners who must meet the criteria of 107Q. CPOs are owners of property that is not the source of the contamination. Such property is contiguous to or otherwise similarly situated to a facility that is the source of contamination found on their property. Further, the Brownfields Amendments clarify the innocent landowner defense of 107B3, where one must perform all appropriate inquiries prior to purchase, as I said, and also not knowing of contamination on the property. All these protections are self-implementing in that the asserting party bears the burden of proving that it meets the conditions of the applicable protection. Ultimately, courts determine whether landowners have met the conditions of the protections. EPA did issue an interim final guidance on the common elements of these landowner liability protections in 2003, known as common elements because the continuing obligations for all three defenses are generally the same. The most relevant continuing obligations in order for a party to maintain liability protection during their property ownership address reasonable steps to stop releases, prevent threatened future releases, and also limit exposure to earlier releases. Further, there are other requirements that a landowner first comply with land use restrictions established or relied on in connection with the response action, and also that the landowner not impede the effectiveness or integrity of any IC employed in connection with the response action. So how does one satisfy these land use restrictions and institutional control elements in order to take advantage of a liability protection? Well, land use restrictions and ICs are not directly defined in the statute or regulations, and the legislative history and case law largely has been unhelpful in defining those terms. So what we're left with is the plain language of the statute. Our guidance documents, the PIME and our common elements guidance, take the position that use restrictions aren't the same as ICs. And I should note that I understand that there is some debate over what constitutes a land use restriction and the breadth of that term. Our common elements guidance notes that ICs are typically designed to achieve the substantive use restrictions selected in a response selection document in order to achieve the cleanup objectives. The guidance also takes a broad interpretation of where one might find documentation of land use restrictions. For instance, they could be found in risk assessments, remedy decision documents, permits or orders or consent decrees, under state response programs, statutes, etc. These restrictions don't have to have been implemented through an enforceable IC. When it comes to what not impeding IC integrity or effectiveness means, we look to whether the party has taken steps that undermine or conflict with the objectives of the IC. Any steps short of physical activities, for example, piercing a cap, may jeopardize the defense. For example, removing a notice that conveys information regarding contamination on site, from land records, failing to give notice of ICs to the purchaser of the property, if the landowner applies for a zoning change or variance, we would think that all of those activities may jeopardize the landowner liability defense would be at play. I should note that EPA believes that land use restrictions should be complied with and ICs implemented even if they were not in place at the time of purchase. One note on the reasonable steps requirement, which I briefly mentioned earlier, which is another common element for the landowner liability protections. IC implementation and or compliance may be a reasonable step in order to be a BFPP, but there is limited case law on this, and this would be based on site-specific circumstances. I mentioned there's limited language out there. We have to look at the plain language of the statute. There's also limited case law on the scope or meaning of what these terms mean. One case that I want to mention that garnered a lot of attention over the last couple of years in the landowner liability world was, as you can see there, Ashley 2 of Charleston, LLC versus PCS Nitrogen, Inc. And that case was affirmed on other grounds recently by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. As some quick background on that case, in case you're interested, Ashley, as a brownfields developer, purchased the site and brought the original case against PCS for remediation costs and reimbursement. PCS then sued Ashley for contribution, and Ashley claimed that it was a BFPP. The district court then denied this defense, and the Fourth Circuit upheld this decision, primarily because Ashley had not taken reasonable steps to limit releases on its property. Unfortunately for our discussion here, the district court did not get into an in-depth analysis of the land use restriction and IC element of the BFPP defense. The court concluded that the defendant had satisfied the LUR IC element of the defense, and it does not address what is meant by being in compliance with any land use restrictions or not impeding the effectiveness or integrity of any IC. And on appeal, the Fourth Circuit unfortunately declined to address these meanings. So here at headquarters, we track these landowner liability cases, but as I mentioned, there hasn't really been much case law defining the IC requirement. So that's why we have to look to the language of the statute. We provided some guidance on what we feel this language means. I do quickly want to conclude by noting that there are a few other resources out there that are great for practitioners if you're looking for additional guidance on IC issues. I will note that different regulators like ASTM, for instance, use different terminology for what we might call ICs. For instance, ASTM uses activity and use limitations, or AULs, which would include both institutional and engineering controls. So that's something to keep in mind as you look at these other resources. So as you can see on there, there's ASTM E2790-11, which is a standard guide for identifying and complying with continuing obligations. It's a good tool to help understand these land use restriction and IC compliance issues. ASTM 2091, it's been available since 2000 and also provides basic guidance on IC issues. And then the ABA book on institutional controls that came out with their second edition in 2012, that provides additional guidance on these issues and what's happening at the federal, state, and private sector level. So with that, I think we have some questions that have come in over the course of this presentation, and we'll try and answer some of those. If we don't get to yours or you have questions after the webinar, definitely feel free to email us at the addresses that you see on this slide. So I'll turn it back to Jean at this point.
Okay, great. Again, just as a reminder to our participants, if you have not yet submitted or perhaps are in the middle of typing up an answer or question, you can continue to do so using the Q&A box that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. We did receive a number of questions from our participants, and I'm going to turn to those that have already been submitted. But if you hear a question and it spawns another one, go ahead. You can keep typing them up, and we'll get through whatever we can in the time that's allotted. I'm going to start with a question that came early on about EPA's ICTS. One of our participants wants to know if the ICTS is available to states and to the public. Again, that's been a concept that's been brought up by multiple participants. Who can get to the ICTS and specifically the database? Is it available to states and the public, or is it just EPA?
Thanks, Jean. Yeah, great question. ICTS is actually, there's kind of two parts of it. There's a part that's sort of not available to the public that we use to kind of do data entry. And then there's a part that is available to the public, which is sort of the output of that data entry. And the sites that are public are the ones where all ICs are implemented at the site. So you may have sites that have multiple IC requirements on different parts of the site. And so until all ICs are implemented, they won't be published to the website. And just to give you that information, in our presentation, we do provide a link to our guidance. You'll notice that is actually part, that link links to, within the Superfund program on the EPA webpage, a specific webpage on institutional controls. The links that we provided are to the guidance we basically have, but on that same webpage, is a listing to what we call site reports, which are the specific ICTS entries that are published on that website. So I definitely encourage you to check that out. I don't know right now what the kind of the filtering requirements is, if you can kind of look at it by state or region of the EPA, but you should be able to get that information for the sites that are.
The IC, or I believe the ICAP guidance, also applicable to RCRA sites.
So yeah, good question. Maybe a little confusing because, you know, we're so CERCLA-based, and you know, primarily as an attorney work on CERCLA issues. But definitely the PIME and the ICAP guidances are cross-program guidances. You know, in the first paragraph of the PIME, it talks about how the information should be useful for CERCLA, brownfields, federal facility, underground storage tanks, and RCRA site cleanups. So while a lot of the language in those documents is, you know, very, very CERCLA-centric, we've also tried to include the other cleanup programs in those documents and also include specific terminology based on those different cleanup programs. I don't know, Steve, if you want to add to that at all, or...
No, that's great. Really, just quick is, you know, like Craig said, it focuses primarily on Superfund, but it was both the PIME and the ICAP are cross-program guidances. They were meant to address kind of the five cleanup programs, waste cleanup programs we have here at EPA. So they were meant to be inclusive of that, and in RCRA in particular, I think there is pretty early on in the document, can't recall the page right now, but some discussion of RCRA corrective action and how some of the guidance here on ICs would play into that framework versus kind of a CERCLA framework.
Okay, great. One of our participants wants to know if you've seen issues with states that have UECAs, or UECAs, I believe, I got that acronym right, being unwilling to implement certain institutional controls. If you have seen those types of issues, what were the specific reasons behind it?
Yeah, this is another great question. You know, on the top of our heads right now, Craig and I are looking at each other. I don't have a great example, but I'd be happy to, you know, get back to you on that, provide an example that falls under kind of that scenario. So I'm sorry to defer that one.
That's okay. One of our next questions would like to know, is there any written guidance on the, quote, best efforts to get landowners to implement the ICs, which you referenced on slide number 13?
Sure, yeah. I referenced that a couple of times on best efforts. Best efforts, it comes from and is outlined in our model, RDRA consent decree, and you know, in that model, just kind of as I said, notes that landowners should use best efforts to get, you know, another property owner for interest to comply with implementing ICs, and that could include reasonable sums of money, for instance. But I don't know of any direct guidance on that issue of what best efforts means. We do periodically update our model RDRA CD, and as those are updated, we may provide staff with a more meaningful description of what best efforts may be. For instance, I've seen language that may clarify things that we would best efforts can mean that what a reasonable and prudent person could do under the circumstances, for instance. But again, I don't know of any direct guidance on that specific issue.
Okay. We do have another participant that wants to know if you would agree that the deed notices do not need to be prepared and recorded if a covenant per UECA is already recorded.
So yes, interesting question. I would say that if the recorded document is, if there's already a recorded Uyghur covenant and that's already in the chain of title, or this would be revealed in something like a title review, for instance, as I mentioned at various points, then I think that would serve the function in terms of notifying other parties of the covenant on the site. So recording a deed notice in that situation may be somewhat redundant. I don't think I'd discourage doing that necessarily. It wouldn't hurt doing that, but I wouldn't say that it's a necessary thing to do in that instance.
Okay. One of our next participants wanted to explore a little bit further on that same concept, but this is reaching back to subordination issues. And they just commented that subordination issues can be really difficult to resolve and take a lot of money and time. They'd like to know, under what situations can we, quote, not resolve the subordination issues and somehow avoid resolving that problem but still give a covenant and then, quote, give the risk to the RP?
Yeah, this is another tough one for us in terms of subordination issues. I haven't directly worked on subordination issues at all, so I could try and come up with an answer to that, but I'd recommend sending me an email. I could follow up with you after I get some more information on that specific question, but please definitely send me an email and I can get back to you once I've thought it out a little more at length.
Yeah, and one thing just to add to that is the ultimate result, whatever the strategy is ultimately to get the IC implemented, in the end, what we're concerned about is getting the IC implemented, how that looks, how that gets done. We have sites where ICs don't get implemented for long periods of time. They're sort of persistent issues. And I think in a broad sense, that's a universe of sites that we really want to get those ICs implemented. So, how it plays out on each specific site, how we do it, what sort of strategy we use, that can change, obviously. But always there should be an eye towards getting the IC implemented in some way. And, in some cases, maybe in rare cases, it maybe changes the type of cleanup approach we use at the site. And that's always a possibility in the end, I think, once you exhaust other options first.
Okay. One of our participants wants to know, is there any guidance for calculating cost estimates for the long-term stewardship of ICs?
Hey, Gene, can you ask that again? I'm sorry.
Sure, not a problem. The question came in and asked, is there or are there any guidance on calculating cost estimates for long-term stewardships of ICs?
Yeah, that's a great question and of interest to a lot of people, both EPA and outside EPA. There's actually been, in addition to some EPA work on the matter, and you'll see this in the PIME guidance, and I do recommend you consulting that guidance for some more information on cost. There was actually an ASWAMO put out a tool for calculating costs of ICs. That's a really useful tool, and we reference it in there, so I really do recommend, taking a look at that.
Okay. One of our participants wanted to know if you could give them an example of a state or locality where information on contaminated soil has actually been integrated into a, quote, one-call system. And if you have, they'd really like to know who the specific contact would be because they want to talk with them about how that information was actually integrated into the system.
Sure. One example, I don't have the an individual contact maybe to give out right now, but I could point you to a resource where I think you can get that information. The state of Illinois has a one-call system called Julie, and the acronym is sort of escaping me now. It's Joint Utility. It's their version of the One Call system, so it's J-U-L-I-E, just like the female name, Julie. They have a system in place, and they've a couple of our Region 5 sites have utilized Julie. So I definitely recommend checking that out.
And we had another participant just chime in that Oregon also has a One Call system as well, so people might want to search for the Oregon One Call system.
Thank you for that.
All right. Well, I do see another online question, and I think this might be a great one to close things out on. Are you and Steve available to review site-specific ICIPs or ICs as part of their five-year review document?
Yeah, absolutely, especially, you know, if the questioner is with EPA, we here at headquarters, Steve and I actually were the two who took the lead in writing the ICAP guidance document. So, and since that was pretty recent, we're always kind of looking for examples of IC plans that utilize that ICAP document or guidance document. So, yeah, we'd definitely be the two to contact here at headquarters if you're interested in developing an ICAP. Steve, I don't know if you want to add to that.
No, I just want to echo what Craig said. Is, you know, we released the ICAP guidance and the PIME. They were released together a year ago, almost to the date a year ago. And so we're really interested in seeing, you know, how can our IC program improve as a result of those guidances getting released. And, you know, a big part with the ICAP is that we provided a template, and we think that, you know, if our regions in particular, EPA regions, start using those kinds of templates, they're starting to think about all those factors, all those considerations that we went through in this presentation. We think that's really critical. So we would be more than happy to be involved in that, review that. So thank you.
Excellent. Gentlemen, do you have any other final comments or ideas you'd like to share with your audience before we start through the final closeout statements for today?
Yeah, just to thank everybody for participating. You know, as you can see, you know, in the EPA, you know, if you've seen the EPA guidance that has gone out on ICs, it's a major priority. It's, you know, even getting ICs implemented is difficult. Maintaining them and enforcing them over the long term is difficult. And so it's something that we are very keen on. We want to keep focusing on. So we appreciate, you know, your participation, getting this kind of information out, and hopefully over time, you know, seeing better results both in implementation and maintenance over time. So thank you very much for everybody's participation.
Yeah, we're really thrilled with what looked to have been a good response, a participation rate for this seminar. And, you know, we have a team here at headquarters that works on these IC issues and related issues. And, you know, for anyone in our regions who needs assistance on IC issues, we definitely have very knowledgeable people here who can help. So, again, backing up with what Steve said, thanks to all for participating.
Wonderful. Well, I want to echo the thanks. We did have almost 130 individuals join us from all over the country for today's live broadcast in the end. So thank you. I also want to extend my thanks to both Steve and Craig, who were able to join us and deliver a great session today. Before we formally close out today's live webinar, I just wanted to provide a few final reminders to our participants. I've already shared two additional URLs in the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. Basically, for those of you that are looking for copies of the presentation material, those are available to download from the seminar homepage. So you can follow the links, or you can check out the resources area, which we have available on the final slide. It is an active hyperlink. And that should pull up a page where you can download the PowerPoint presentation materials. That page will remain active from this point forward. So for those of you that might be replaying the archived version of this broadcast, you too can still go down to that site and download a copy of the materials. Lastly, we will ask each participant to take a moment and fill out our very short feedback form. We're continuously trying to improve our sessions, and we do count on your feedback to be able to help us improve our sessions as well as continue to offer the seminars. So if you thought this was useful and you'd like to see more sessions like this in the future, please let us know through our online feedback form. If you shared the line with multiple parties under one registration, each person can actually take a chance, take their own turn and fill out their own feedback form. There'll be a link that will appear once you submit the form for the next person to hop on and fill it out. And again, that link is available from this point forward. So if you need to fill out the form later today or tomorrow, or perhaps there are replaying a recorded version, you too can follow the links to our online feedback form. For anyone who's looking to verify their participation today for online training credits, we do recognize there are many different organizations and training requirements for online sessions. So I'd encourage you all to save a copy or print out a copy of the registration email, as well as perhaps download a copy of at least the seminar homepage or the seminar slides. If you fill out the online feedback form, there is a box that you can check, which is circled in red on this last slide, that will allow us to send you a confirmation email after you share feedback from the live delivery. It also will work for those of you replaying the session. So as long as your email address is filled out correctly on the feedback form, you'll get another email that you can save. And usually if you take your registration or the seminar homepage along with that feedback verification email, you'll be able to earn credit and document that you were here or at least participated through the entire session. If anybody needs any other help, we do have an online training record lookup system on the CLUIN website. Feel free to send an email to ballant.gene@epa.gov. I'll be more than happy to help you look up your records. That's the end of the final reminders that I had for everyone today. So again, a great big thank you to the individuals who joined us live, as well as to both of our instructors. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.